What's up, everyone? I hope we're all having a great day today. Today's episode is one that I'm very excited about. It's been something that I've personally been following since I was a kid on documentaries and just kind of in TV shows and stuff like that, so I'm pretty excited about it. It's also something that sheds a lot of light into the deep corners of Werrytown history, so I'm very excited about it. I will go ahead and just pass the mic to Dr. Henry. Dr. Henry is my guest today. He is a marine archaeologist, also known as a maritime archaeologist. I actually found that out today. So I'm going to stop my blabbering. Mr. Henry, Dr. Henry, I'm so sorry. Please take over.
The oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear. And the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown. A quote from H.P. Lovecraft. This story takes place about, I want to say, closer to 8 months ago. It all started with a call at, I want to say, 3:12 a.m. I received a call from my associate, Dr. Anthony, who was informing me of some good news. He got the green light to do excavation on the Yahtzee Wall at the bottom of Mandy Shore. Now, if you're not sure what the Yahtzee Wall is, it's a conspiracy theory from the late 80s, and there's been documentaries every now and then kind of talking about the progress that they're making with it. But unless you're a Werrytown resident, you're not really going to know too much of the Yahtzee Wall, especially because it's not really on documentaries anymore. But in order to tell you more about that, I need to first fill you in on the Yahtzee Wall and everything about that, or else you're not going to have context for what I'm about to tell you. It's not going to make any sense. I'll make sure to keep it short but sweet, but let's start at the beginning. Now, the Yahtzee Wall is something that dates back to the Neolithic era. If you're not sure when the Neolithic era was, it was after the Paleolithic era. About 608 BCE or 3,800 years ago, give or take. It was at a time where human evolution, we were able to raise cattle and other animals. We had farms going on and made small artwork and also had a somewhat established community going on. Now, we're not sure the name of the people that lived there. They never disclosed a name nor hinted at anything nor anything like that, so we just call them the Telebu people or the Telebu tribe. Now, what we know from them is that at some point they migrated from the caves of Werri or the mountains of Werri, and they migrated about 23 miles closer to the beach. We're not really sure what exactly happened, but I'm going to try to go ahead and just say what happened. So at some point, the Telebu tribe is actually a part of another tribe known as what the Telebus call them, the Uguay people. Now, they lived in a cave system in the mountains of Werri. And if you have special access passes from the government and things like that, you're able to actually go into those cave systems and see the cave art that they left behind. But the Telebu tribe moved away from them and started their own settlement somewhere else. Again, 23 miles away from the mountains. The Telebu tribe very quickly established their own settlement. They've got livestock, as well as they're able to grow grains and other types of food. They have a little training area for the hunters that go out, as well as an area for newborns and toddlers to kind of play around with and have social skills and things like that as well. We know this through the various forms of art that the Telebu tribe left behind. Whether it's just simple wall art, or it's art that they put on vases, tapestries, plates, things like that, and not to mention wooden statues that they carved out as well. So that's how we know about their history. Now, the reason why you haven't heard anything about the Atsi Wall on documentaries or in the news or on TV or anything like that is because it's oftentimes disregarded as a hoax from the start. There's a bunch of people out there just ready to debunk it without even listening to the story. There's people out there who are just saying it's a hoax, it's fake, so they don't really give it the time of day, which, if you don't know how science works, it's worked by funding. And when a lot of people came out to say that it's a hoax, this Atsi Wall didn't get funding anymore. But that's for later on. I'm getting ahead of myself. Now, the reason why you probably haven't heard of the Atsi Wall and why it's so disregarded as a hoax is because it's possibly the oldest evidence of the supernatural in human history, let alone Werrytown history. What I mean by that is that the Atsi Wall is comprised of a singular piece of marble. Four corners, smoothed out, all symmetrical, 91 acres in area, and on all four walls, it's 50 feet, but on all four corners, it is an additional 20 feet of just monolithic pyramid shape on there. And it's said to be structured by nature itself, which is just absolutely breathtaking and outstanding to believe that it was just there so conveniently. But it gets weirder from there. Written on the inside of the Atsi Wall in clear, perfect carving is a Mesopotamian alphabet. More of a story, but I'll get to that in one moment. But we dated Mesopotamian language to date back to 3100 BCE. That means that the Mesopotamian written inside of the Atsi Wall is 2,492 years before the Mesopotamian language was dated. So this is another thing. Now, there are pieces of the wall missing. We don't have the completed wall, although we're constantly trying to find more pieces of it. But from what we can accumulate, we found out that whatever's written inside of the wall has much more than we can ever have. But from what we've gathered, it seems to be some sort of story of creation. We're not exactly sure which kind of story of creation it's referring to. Again, we're missing a good amount of pieces, but what we can put together was that our confirmation that the Telugu tribe did disband themselves from the Ogwe tribe. There were mentions of gods inside of the caves and gods of the outside, some sort of war that happened, and the Ogwe people are referred to as the enemy of man. And there's some depictions of beasts that are still unknown about. Now, what we know from the Telugu people, or the Telugu tribe, is that they were constantly harassed by the Ogwe people. There's various forms of art that depict the Ogwe people and the Telugu tribe going to war with each other. There's also mention from the Telugu tribe of air beasts and beasts that are on land and in the ocean that are unexplainable. It looks like aliens if you were to look at it, or it looks like just dinosaurs or just ancient beasts, but the Telugu tribe depicts them as being these monstrous and grotesque, almost Cthulhu-esque like monsters and beasts. throughout the Telebu history, we see accounts of them migrating. Not all at once, though. It was little by little. A few dozen would go with a passing by tribe and become tribes for them, or a few dozen of them would leave and migrate and start their own tribe, or whatever have you. It got to the point where the Ugwe tribes are starting to outweigh the Telebu tribes, and we see this in their art. We see that as their artwork started to progress, we saw less and less of it, and it became a little bit more violent each time. We believe that at some point, the Telebu tribe just abandoned the settlement altogether. We estimate that another thing that caused the Telebu tribe to start to disband was what we estimate to be a Category 7 earthquake. It happened off the shore of what's now Mandy Shore, but pretty much the whole shoreline moved in, because when that earthquake happened, it almost acted like a sinkhole, where just the beach, which was 4 miles away from the settlement, I mind you, started just collapsing in to the point where it just swallowed up a good chunk of the Yahtzee wall, and it just crashed down. Now, we don't know the full story because we're not there. These are just estimates of what happened. But another thing that happened is at some point we estimate that when the Telebu tribe abandoned the settlement completely, that at some point the Ugwe tribe came back to just completely decimate the rest of the land. We say this because in the Yahtzee wall, we see a number of smashes, cracks, bashes from blunt objects. We see that there's just a bunch of markings that people deliberately tried to destroy this area. And that's why we have so little of the Yahtzee wall to study. But this is where the story I'm telling now comes in. You see, as time went on, the ocean started to take up more of the settlement, more and more. And now today, we have a good majority of the settlement is under water still, while a little bit of the settlement is now known as a marshland. It's treated like a marshland now, so we're losing a lot of it. But the good news is that we moved a lot of very valuable and very just great historical pieces to our local museum. But in the early 80s, when we first started to do excavation of the Yahtzee wall, there were times where scuba instructors would come down, or maybe submarines would come down, whatever you may have, coming down to do excavation on the Yahtzee wall. But they all came into the same problem: silt. Now, if you don't know what silt is this underwater debris and dust that just is sitting at the very bottom of the ocean. And if you're not careful, when you're swimming by or moving things around, it'll usually throw silt up into pretty much your eye view. Now with silt, you have to be very careful. You can easily get lost in silt. It's so thick, and it's so just, you know, it's this cloud that you can't see through. You can't even see your hands in front of you. So a lot of times divers will swim up thinking that they're swimming down or some other direction, in reality when they're swimming the opposed direction that they're trying to swim to. So even very trained and well-established scuba instructors and scuba divers have to keep their wit about silt. So that's been a big issue as to why we have never really been able to uncover the Yahtzee wall. It's just this big monolithic marble wall that's been sunken in, and there's just all the sand, all this gravel, this dirt, mud, everything like that on top of it. So when scuba divers or submarines start trying to move things around, a lot of silt will come up, and they'll either run out of air and have to go back up, or with submarines, when you're paying for it, you know, by the hour, and you know, you're on an excavation that's about 6 hours long, and only 1 hour of that is just actually moving things around, it's not the most affordable. Also, please keep in mind that earlier I also said that science is pretty much funded, by interest. So because there's not a lot of interest as to the Otzi wall, this project normally doesn't receive too much funding. So now, with all that backstory given, let's return to the actual story at hand. My associate, Dr. Anthony, called me, gave me the green light. We're going to be excavating on this day. Get ready for it. Do whatever preparations you need to do. It was 3 months out. So in those 3 months, I let my job know, hey, I'm not going to be here for this time. Cashed in all my PTO, got all the equipment I needed for my lab, from home, stuff like that, and went on the excavation. Or we set out to go for the drive. Now, with Mandy Shore, if you're not familiar with Mandy Shore is about an 8 mile long ocean that just stretches, and it's this really popular ocean. Everybody goes to it. In Werrytown, there's only two oceans or two beaches, so everybody usually goes on over to the beach. Mandy Shore is a really popular one, but it's about an 8 mile beach, but about six of those are actually areas that you can swim in. The last 2 miles are left for the whole excavation and everything like that regarding the Otzi wall. The Otzi wall is no longer a structure, but its remains are still there. So we were driving out. I'll spare you the detail about getting on the boat, all the stuff. We're out there. We sailed out to where we need to be. We're at the location. We've been checking maps, radars, everything like that, making preparations, stuff like that. And we're in the submarine, and we are descending finally to the Otzi wall. I was in the submarine with Dr. Anthony, and we were making the descent while we were checking our maps, our sonars, our lights, propellers, everything. We were good to go. And we finally got down to the ocean floor, and we went ahead to where the wreckage of the Otzi wall is, with all the rubble and everything like that. With modern day submarine technology, we now have technology to battle the silt if it were to come up. We've got lights, we've got cameras, we've got special jet propulsions, we've got different types of scanners, things like that to help us deal with the silt. We're not able to fully work in the silt, but we can maintain it where if silt brushes up, we don't need to immediately stop. We can turn on a special light or turn on a special camera, activate a special jet propulsion system, stuff like that, to kind of clear some silt. And then if it really brushes up, then yeah, we just kind of back out for a little bit, take some time, and then we go back and do it again. But for the most part, we don't need to stop excavation. We just slow it down, if anything. And then, like I said, if it's really bad, then we go ahead and stop it. So we're there, and we're moving very slowly because we know the notorious silt that'll fly up if we move too quickly. So we're moving things with the mechanical arms of the submarine, and we're able to get through a good amount of it. At some point, there was some silt issues, but again, we just turned on our special equipment, and we just decided to work a little bit slower, and we were able to pretty much dig through it pretty much. We started finding rubble of the actual Otzi wall, which was something that was just marvelous. It was something that I've been waiting to do since I was a child, and I felt that the child in me let weight off of his back when we finally came across the wall and I got to see it at the ocean floor with my own two eyes. I could not describe it, honestly. It was just out of this world. At some point while we were digging, though, we came across a very clear text in the Mesopotamian language. We saw a carving, and we pulled out our book of known carvings for this language. And we were just kind of going through it very quickly, diligently. We wanted to read it as we were going. just kind of for record keeping sake. And so we were doing that, and we found the translation. Enemy of man is what it said. As we were digging, we were just moving things little by little, going very slow, and we came across a plank of wood. One plank quickly became more, and we even found what looked to be like very old, ancient caskets bound in, I want to say, hemp or roots or something that resembled rope. We saw that some of the caskets were broken. We saw a plank of wood and another one, and soon we even found bodies buried in the rubble. This came a little bit as a shock to us, but we also understood that there was a possibility of this happening, but that's not what disturbed us. The fact that we were seeing a dead body underwater was not what disturbed us. The fact that it was perfectly preserved, the fact that they didn't look like they were decomposing, they didn't look old, they didn't look anything like that. They looked preserved, perfectly preserved. When I say perfectly preserved, I mean it. It was in that moment that we heard a bloop from one of our microphones outside. It was a bloop like an air pocket just released. Before we could think anything of it, we saw these bodies getting up. They were noticing us, looking at us, and they started moving towards us. Some of them fell from rocks onto the ocean floor, and silt flew up, but the bodies just got up and started walking towards us. There was a large silt cloud in front of us, and I don't know if it was intentional or if it was just reaction, but we started backing up the submarine. We put it in reverse and started backing up. It was going slow. This submarine wasn't really meant for speed. But we started backing up, and in the light coming through the silt, we saw these bodies walking towards us. They didn't look like zombies. They looked like disproportionate humans, like they were trying to look human but weren't human. They were walking towards us, and through our underwater microphone we heard that they were clicking with their mouths to each other. They were making moans and groans. They were making all these noises, these bellows and everything like that, as if they were trying to communicate with each other. We couldn't understand a single thing of it, but once they got close enough, they started swatting at us like they were trying to attack us. Again, this sub wasn't meant for speed, but we were trying to get out of there. We flashed our high beam lights at them, hoping that it would stop them or make them just stop in their steps or deter them for even a bit, but nothing. They didn't seem to be distracted by it at all. We even tried to use our propeller system to help us move a little bit closer or a little bit faster behind us so that we can get out of there, but nothing would work. We eventually started raising, but at that point they started just throwing rocks that they would find on the ground at us, or sticks or whatever may have you, at us. It was loud, but it wasn't doing damage to the sub. I remember that we made it back to the surface, and we were just trying to contemplate what happened. The crew was trying to talk to us, but we just wanted to get out of there. We just told them that we had to leave. Ever since then, we haven't really published anything that we found that day, but I'm guessing that someday soon we'll have to publish it or talk about it or something like that, because, well, I'm going on a podcast about it too. I'm not sure exactly what that was that we encountered. I'm not sure what happened, but it just goes to show that this town has been weird even before it was even an established town.